John and Sarah Connor would break into Cybertine and... Cybertine?
Expectant mothers and persons with heart, back, neck, or other similar conditions should see an attendant for assistance.
You're listening to Attraction Obsession, the podcast that takes an in-depth look at some of the most famous theme park attractions from all over the country. Backstories, histories, and behind-the-scenes secrets of some of your favorite rides. Now here is your host of Attraction Obsession, Matt.
Welcome to Attraction Obsession. This is episode one. My name is Matt from NeoZaz.com. And in this episode, I'll be taking an in-depth look at the Universal Studios attraction, Terminator 2 3D Battle Across Time. To start things off, we will start with the question, what is Terminator 2 3D Battle Across Time? And for the answer, we're going to turn to Universal Studios Florida's website and look at the official attraction pitch, which currently reads, Terminator 2 3D is a spellbinding mix of live-action stunts, special effects, and amazing 3D filmmaking. You'll feel like you can reach out and touch the characters and feel like the cyborgs can reach out and touch you as well. Featuring both familiar characters from the Terminator movies and an array of all new characters, it's a totally unique experience that will have you saying, hasta la vista, baby, to entertainment as you know it. Now that's a pretty fair in a nutshell description, but for me, I think there's really a few things that separate this ride from a lot of other attractions that, and make it really unique. The first is the main feature of the 3D. Now, 3D was not new by any means when this attraction opened and was even developed, but the finale of the 3D portion of this ride or this attraction, the last 3 minutes of the 3D extends over three 23 foot by 50 foot screens, making a total of 3,500 square feet of 3D being projected. Another element is that the actual story of this attraction takes place directly after the events in 1991's Terminator 2 Judgment Day, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, Edward Furlong, and Robert Patrick. And unlike the other Terminator movies before it, this one sends characters forward into the future rather than bringing future characters to the present. Another unique feature, or at least in my opinion, a really cool feature, is to start the main show off. There are six 8 feet tall, 4 foot wide, fully animatronic T-70 robots and targets that drop from the ceiling over the audience that these robots shoot at in a demonstration. That I had no idea was coming the very first time I saw this ride and thought that was really cool. But we'll get into my first experience with this ride a little later in the show because I want to keep going on this list and get to what I think for me and for a lot of people is the main thing, the main piece that makes this attraction unique from any other 3D attraction out there, and that is the live performance element. There are live actors portraying Sarah Connor, John Connor, the T-1000, and the Terminator himself that interact with the 3D elements on the screen, and literally, I mean, I'm using the word literally correctly here, they run in and out of the movie. So I think that's a broader explanation of what the attraction is. Now, where the attraction is, it first opened at Universal Studios Florida on April 27th, 1996. And at one time, there were three venues of this attraction running across three Universal Studios parks. The second venue was at Universal Studios Hollywood, having opened on May 6, 1999. The third venue opened over 7,000 miles away from the original location at Universal Studios Japan in Osaka, Japan, on March 31st, 2001. Now, of those three venues, the Florida and Japan attractions are still running, at least as of this recording. The Hollywood venue sadly did close. It was on December 31st, 2012, and that entire area of the park has now been repurposed for the Despicable Me Minion Mayhem attraction. So the chances of Terminator coming back, not looking so good. Doubt that's going to happen. In fact, it's safe to say that's not going to happen, I think. So now that we know what we're talking about and where to find it, let's do what I'm currently referring to as a virtual walkthrough of the attraction. Now, before I start, there's a couple things I wanted to say here quickly. Most importantly is that if you don't like spoilers and you've not been on this attraction, this is the point to stop playing this episode. I'm going to go through a lot of detail on what happens, and I have some sound bites that help set the stage. So if you don't want to hear any spoilers about this ride, or for that matter, how the ride works or any of the behind-the-scenes info, stop now because that's all that's going to happen the rest of this episode. The other thing I wanted to say was to preface this walkthrough a bit and say, this is, with this being my first official episode of Attraction Obsession, I'm still working some elements out, and none of them more than this one. I'm still working out on what seems to work best for these walkthroughs. So with having to try something to get that baseline to improve on, I've scripted out this portion of the episode. So I'll now be putting on my best audiobook narrator voice, and then we're going to go back to working from my notes here, and I'll be a little more, the presentation should come out a little more naturally. All right, with all that out of the way, here we go. Walking through the Hollywood area of Universal Studios, Florida, we see a modern architectural building standing along the street view. It's building number 6889, and the chrome-plated words Cyberdyne Systems are mounted on a curved overhang over the entrance. We enter the building, where we're led down a hall past red LED security scanners that silently look over each visitor. Above the doorway into the queuing area, the words, "We are the future," are engraved over our heads. The queue line is formed with steel railing and chains, surrounded by polished steel walls with bright white wall sconces. Posters on the columns and walls highlight some of Cyberdyne's latest innovations and technologies for the home, medical fields, and military defense. Overhead, the ceiling is adorned with monitors playing informational videos on Cyberdyne, history and news, and a few music selections, all provided by the Cyberdyne Interactive Network. A notable recurring theme in the newsreels is the attack years ago on Cyberdyne by Sarah and John Connor. The two, along with an unidentified accomplice, nearly destroyed Cyberdyne forever. But these videos are quick to report that Cyberdyne is alive and well and better than ever. At the end of the queue, we await to enter the Miles Dyson Memorial Auditorium for the first part of the presentation. Before entering, we're told to pick up a pair of safety glasses and told we'll need them later in the demonstration. The doors open, and we enter the staging area into the Miles Dyson Memorial Auditorium.
It sure is nice to see so many friendly faces here today. Systems. My name is Kimberly Duncan. You can say hi, I'm not television. How unsolicited. Hello.
After a brief wait, we're welcomed by the Director of Community Relations and Media Control for Cyberdyne Systems, Kimberly Duncan, as she informs us that we're about to witness a classified demonstration of Cyberdyne's latest and most exciting technology, starting with a video presentation about more on Cyberdyne.
Imagine a world where butterflies run on batteries. Imagine a school system where children in Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, and Seattle all learn exactly the same lesson from exactly the same teacher at exactly the same time every day.
The presentation starts off calmly, showing a battery-powered butterfly fluttering across a sun-filled meadow. Examples of the innovation and advanced technologies Cyberdyne will bring to our lives fills the large wall screens. Entertainment, sports, medicine, and even personal interactions will all soon be enhanced by Cyberdyne technologies. All of these intriguing enhancements are just a prelude to Cyberdyne's ultimate objective.
That's right, Cyberdyne. We're back, bigger and better than ever, and we're ready to lead the world down the information superhighway. Our goal, complete domination of global communications.
The presentation begins to turn a bit ominous as Cyberdyne presents its advanced military and defensive technologies and reveals its most ambitious project yet.
Skynet. When the Skynet system comes online, this nation and its allies will be protected by the Ultimate Guardian, the first fully computer-controlled defense system.
Skynet has the ability to watch anyone, anywhere in the world, from any distance, and with full control over the nation's army and nuclear arsenal, can react instantly to any detected threat, taking all defenses completely out of human hands. The video begins to flicker. An incoming transmission is breaking through.
Cyberdyne Systems, the future of information systems and robotics, the future of national defense. Cyberdyne Systems.
Are we in?
Easy money.
Okay, listen to me, everybody. We don't have much time. Skynet is your enemy. It must be destroyed before it destroys us. Don't believe this cutesy pie video and their slick marketing. These corporate pigs aren't selling safety, they're selling death. They should all be taken out and barbecued.
Commissioner, remember? She's a little tense. Okay, attention everyone in this building. This is a warning from the human resistance. Cyberdyne is a menace. Skynet threatens the future of the human race. We're gonna stop it. You have 5 minutes to get out. Repeat, all civilians in this building have 5 minutes to get out.
Sarah and John Connor have hacked directly into Cyberdyne. Sarah and John have footage of what's happened in the past, and they thought they stopped it, but it's all about to happen again. This time, they plan to stop the completion of Skynet at the source, Cyberdyne. A frantic Kimberly Duncan calls security, trying to get control of the presentation back.
Skynet must never be completed. Get out of the building. You have been warned. You have 5 minutes before we will...
Making the future safer and friendlier for everyone.
In the end, the Cyberdyne presentation video ends, and Kimberly assures us we have nothing to worry about and have certainly heard the last of Sarah and John Connor.
I would like to take a moment to apologize for that silly interruption, right? I'm afraid it only takes a few sad, warped individuals to just ruin things for everyone, doesn't it? But I promise you, we have seen the last of them, so super!
The audience is then led into the main demonstration area, the 700-seat, state-of-the-art, custom-built theater. The audience is quickly seated as Kimberly continues her demonstration, announcing, "Ladies and gentlemen, here at Cyberdyne Systems, armed combat has entered the age of robotics," and proudly introduces the latest of Cyberdyne's robotic technology, the Synthetic Soldier, the Cyberdyne T-70 Autonomous Infantry Unit, or Terminator for short. The audience is told to put on their safety visors as the T-70s demonstrate their firepower and accuracy.
Automatic targeting systems active. Laser designators active. Prepare to fire. Lock and run. Commence firing.
The demonstration of the T-70s finishes, but this is just the beginning as the curtain raises to show a shiny chrome Cyberdyne logo and Kimberly begins to announce the Skynet project. Before Kimberly can finish her first sentence, an explosion from the rafters is heard, and sirens begin to blare. Kimberly takes her place at the podium, attempting to rearm the T-70 Terminators. Sarah orders her to stop, and to emphasize her point, she fires into the wall, three of them piercing the chrome logo. Strangely, the bullet holes in the Cyberdyne logo close. The logo quickly and smoothly changes into a face atop a long, bending fluid arm. The face searches over the audience, saying the names.
John.
Face lunges back, the silver mask forms into a figure. The T-1000 is now live and on stage. The T-1000 quickly crosses the stage to the podium. Kimberly mistakenly recognizes him as a Cyberdyne security officer and begins vocally chastising him for not stopping the Connors.
Security, there you are! I called you to come up here and get the Connors, not prance around my stage like a cat. The Connors! Get the Connors!
Her abuse is short-lived as the T-1000 clutches Kimberly by the throat, lifts her several feet in the air, and casually discards her lifeless body. The T-1000 continues the T-70 rearming process Kimberly had begun, but the Terminator is now armed and begins to target the Connors. Moments before firing, an electrical distortion starts at the right corner of the stage. It's a time portal forming. The portal opens and the Terminator enters, riding the Harley-Davidson onto the stage.
I said I'd be back.
Armed with a shotgun, he fires at the T-1000, temporarily knocking him to the floor. John climbs onto the back of the motorcycle. The T-1000 rises to his feet. Sarah and the Terminator fire on him, knocking him down one more time. The Terminator revs the engine, driving the motorcycle into the screen and into the time portal, taking John and himself to the future. John and the Terminator find themselves in a post-apocalyptic war zone, followed by the T-1000 entering through a second time portal. His hands form into arm hooks hovering over the audience. John and the Terminator make their way through the battle zone, with the T-1000 in pursuit. A close-range shotgun blast splits the T-1000's head in two, stopping the machine in its tracks. Ahead is Skynet, their target.
That's Skynet?
Yep.
Can I ask why we're heading toward it?
You don't want to know.
A hunter-killer flies overhead, targets the heroes, and opens fire. A wreck on the motorcycle forces John and the Terminator to continue on foot.
What's that?
Mini-hunters, keep moving!
The two make their way through the ruins. A set of mini-hunters are released to follow them in the close confines. The Terminator eliminates the mini-drones one by one, but before the audience can catch its breath, a full endoskeleton Terminator attacks the duo.
Get down!
The chrome Terminator endoskeleton zeroes in on John, with the laser sights of his plasma rifle centered in John's forehead. Before he can pull the trigger, the Terminator destroys the robot killer with the remnants of one of the crippled mini-hunters.
Hey, Buckethead!
Now armed with a plasma rifle and a satchel of impact explosives, John and the Terminator run into Skynet as the armored doors begin to close. The room goes black. A set of small lights switch on. The Terminator and John are standing center stage. The illusion of an elevator starts as the two additional screens on each side of the theater are revealed, lowering the heroes and the audience into the depths of Skynet.
So this is where you're built, huh?
Affirmative. No human has ever seen this place.
The elevator stops in front of our hero's target, Skynet CPU.
So what kind of response systems do they have down here?
There's only one, but it's a good one. It's called the T-1 million. Move! Get out of sight!
A gated structure surrounding the CPU morphs into the silver spider-like T-1 million, an incredibly large mimetic poly-alloy Terminator that transforms its appendages into stabbing and slashing weapons. Pinpointing a tank of liquid nitrogen, the Terminator shoots the tank, freezing the T-1 million.
Go. We don't have much time.
He then follows with a single shot, shattering the T-1 million into millions of pieces. The pieces begin to thaw. The T-1 million starts to reform, but this takes just long enough for the Terminator to start a time portal, sending John back to the present.
20 seconds, go! I'll be back. Now go, run!
And for the Terminator to swing into the CPU, slamming the explosives into the surface and sacrificing himself while destroying Skynet. The room fills with smoke. The audience feels the impact as the floor suddenly drops with a thud. Sarah and John join each other on stage for a short epilogue. Judgment Day has been prevented. The audience is safe and exits the theater. Okay, I hope that painted a pretty fair picture of this attraction. I specifically hope that it demonstrated that there is a lot going on in this ride. I mean, a ton more than just a 3D movie playing to a crowd of several hundred people. So, exactly what all is going on and what goes into one showing of Terminator 2 3D? And for that matter, where did all these pieces come from in the first place? Well, that is the idea behind this podcast, and we're about to find out those answers right now. To start this story, we're going to have to start a little bit about the early days of Universal Studios Florida. Universal Studios Florida opened in 1990 and hit the ground kind of struggling. The original concept of it being equal parts theme park and working production studios wasn't gelling too well at the get-go. The studio production side wasn't really drawing the long-term high-profile projects it hoped to, and now Disney World was cutting into the theme park side with their own project, at the time their third park called MGM Studios. But Universal did have a couple of things worth getting excited about, namely Confrontation and Jaws, two large-scale, big-name movie-themed rides that were getting a lot of attention and a lot of praise from visitors and from park industry professionals. So by the end of 1991, the shift of expanding the theme park side of the operations and increasing the attraction list started to be their primary focus. So the obvious place to start on this new focus was to bring in another big-name movie attraction. that previous summer, the summer of 1991, one film stood out, and that was Terminator 2 Judgment Day. It was a smash hit in the box office. It was a hit with audiences, and it was a rare, the third element of those three, the critical hit. It hit all marks. Critics loved it, audiences loved it, and it made a ton of money. The action of this movie, the characters, the story, the franchise itself, it fit the mold perfectly for what Universal Studios was looking to add to their theme park. So in early 1992, Universal approached Landmark Entertainment about a new potential attraction idea. Universal had worked with Landmark before. Landmark Entertainment had created, developed, and produced a pretty popular and actually really successful Conan the Barbarian themed stunt show for Universal Studios Hollywood. So going with what they already knew worked, Universal pretty much wanted Landmark to just strike gold again and do kind of the same thing, but this time with Terminators. Landmark did take the job and did initially try to come up with a concept that would fit exactly what Universal asked for. The creative team at Landmark sat through several viewings of Terminator 2 looking for ideas, to identify the iconic moments and elements to include in their show. The show with the Terminator 2 name on it, it had to deliver on the expectations that name was going to give the audience as they walked into the attraction. If it didn't, this attraction was going to fail. Knowing this, Landmark came to a quick realization that a stunt show was not going to be able to deliver on these expectations. Terminator 2 is such a visually stunning movie and bringing many of these elements that you would expect to see when you hear the name Terminator 2 solely to a live performance, just it wasn't going to happen. But during this process, Landmark Entertainment came up with another idea that may work for the Terminator franchise. And this idea revolved all around the question, wouldn't it be cool if the T-1000 melted off the screen and onto the stage? Considering that question alone, that really helped make everything fall into place at this point. The iconic elements could be back on the big screen while the live actors were on stage, and the two could interact. This idea was unique, it was out of the box, and it was not at all what Universal Studios asked for. So the pitch was difficult, to say the least. They were skeptical, in a word. The idea had never been done before. There was zero frame of reference, no example. In the minds of the creative team, everything worked and it was awesome. But to the executives and the number crunchers at Universal, it was a little hard to envision. But in reality, none of this even mattered, because no matter what attraction Universal Studios, Landmark Entertainment, or anyone else had come up with, the idea still had to go through James Cameron first, and that was a hurdle that hadn't even begun to be cleared at this point. Landmark Entertainment bravely took on this task and invited Cameron to their offices in LA to pitch their idea, the full-blown 3D / special effects / live actor / way over the top extravaganza. Now, by his own admission, and in more than one interview, Cameron has said that he went into this meeting having made up his mind that this was just not going to happen. His Terminator franchise was not going to be turned into some theme park attraction. There is no way in hell there was going to be a Terminator version of It's a Small World. And now that I say that aloud, might actually be kind of cool if done right. When Cameron walked into the room that was set up for the presentation, the walls were lined with hundreds of concept sketches of the attraction, everything from the beginning to the end, and every single possible detail that could be done in a sketch was on that wall. This spun Cameron's decision into a complete 180. He liked what he saw. The idea was good, and he even said so, but he also said that he could make it better. At this point, James Cameron himself had joined the project as writer and director of the film portion of the attraction. And the first big change and improvement he put into place was the casting. The original show idea was to just feature a Terminator, a general, run-of-the-mill, off-the-assembly-line Terminator. Maybe he sort of kind of looked like Arnie, but it wasn't going to be him, so they could cast someone else, someone a lot cheaper. Cameron changed the idea right off the bat with the notion that if you're going to do a Terminator project, there is only one Terminator, and that is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Cameron continued to work on improving the script and developed the story as a continuation of where Judgment Day left off. And this improvement to the story lent itself to include Sarah and John Connor. So now Linda Hamilton and Edward Furlong were now in the casting pool. And what the hell, to make it a full T2 story expansion, let's go ahead and bring in Robert Patrick as a T-1000. So this raised the budget substantially. It went from, I don't know what, I can't find a number of what it started with, but I can tell you it ended at an astonishing $24 million. Now, that doesn't sound like much for a movie, especially by today's standards, but this was almost 20 years ago, and the movie only runs for 12 minutes, so it might be better to say that the budget went to $2 million per minute. And since the project had already hit the $2 million per minute mark, they went ahead and brought in Hollywood practical effects master Stan Winston to add his signature iconic elements to the movie, including the Terminator endoskeletons, which would now also be featured pretty prominently in this film. This new budget, I'm sure, made the executives at Universal think, but ultimately having a direct sequel to 1991's biggest movie with the original cast, this was a risk well worth taking. It was a unique opportunity, and they were going to do their best to capitalize on it. With the project fully greenlit now, the final draft of the shooting script was done, as well as the pre-show and the overall story of the attraction. John and Sarah Connor would break into Cyberdyne and destroy the entire complex to keep Skynet from being built. The T-1000 would be lurking around there to stop them. The one true Terminator would arrive just in the nick of time to take John to the year 2029, which is only 15 years from now, by the way, to destroy Skynet itself during the final battle between humans and machines. Now, to get that on film, on stage, and get that dramatic triple screen finale created and out of the computer. And all those elements would be worked on simultaneously in three different areas of the country. First, let's talk about the 3D film, the live portion, not the CG. We're going to cover that pretty soon here. This already impressive Hollywood big name lineup for crew and cast needed one more member to round out its band. The 3D element needed an experienced hand to help guide it along, and they got it when they brought in Chuck Comiskey, whose 3D credits at the time included Jaws 3D and more, much more impressive, a Planet Mars 3D surface mapping project. Now with the crew finally in place, they could finally get underway. They just needed to get the cameras. Easy, right? Well, the cameras did need to meet a couple of criteria. With the proposed multi-screen finale and the massive screen size, at least for the time, the film needed to be shot in the highest resolution available. Now, this was well before digital cinema. This is well before 4K, and the best option to pull this off at the time was to shoot on 65mm film that was developed onto 70mm projection prints. Out of curiosity, I looked up 65mm film cameras today, and they're freaking big. And I could only imagine that 20 years ago, they were probably even bigger. Even if they weren't, they're not small things to handle. And my point here is that it was shot in 3D, so Cameron needed to use two of them mounted side by side. So this thing was colossal. Now, the idea of placing the cameras side by side is not new. 3D had been done on film since the 1950s. What was new was making the camera fit Cameron's shooting and directing style, and ultimately making the film fit as a Terminator movie. This was a little more challenging. When the two of these cameras were mounted together, the cameras and the mounting system weighed 600 pounds. Cameron's style is constant movement, large sweeping shots and dramatic angles. These two things were not made for each other right out of the box. An entirely new set of rigging equipment was designed and made just for the shoot to allow this nearly half ton of camera rig to accommodate Cameron's vision of the film. So with that obstacle overcome, now shooting could start. The shoot took place at the abandoned Eagle Mountain iron ore mine in Desert City, California, at the California-Arizona border, and it was over a period of 3 weeks and all at night. This location shoot covers the time in the attraction where John and the Terminator arrive to the future to the time they entered Skynet, a mere 9 minutes of the entire 3D experience. Now, Cameron was very meticulous and very careful about the 3D shots that were going to show up on this film. He wanted there to be plenty, but he didn't want them to be cheap or even obvious. The best way to explain this is to play this quote from James Cameron himself.
For me, the trick to doing 3D is to not to have one kind of gag where something's coming straight out at you after another. You have to tell a story, you have to have a narrative, and you have to stick to the normal cinematic style. And then every once in a while, if something should happen to come off the screen and come into the audience,
all right, that's it.
You try to integrate that in an organic way so the audience doesn't feel like they're just getting poked in the eye one time after another, even though the goal is to poke them in the eye one time after another.
Now, a lot is made about the CGI effects in this film, and rightfully so, because the entire 3 minutes of the film are CG, and like I said earlier, we will be covering that. But one thing I think that gets way overlooked and has for years are the practical effects. First, the explosions alone. These explosions on screen are the real thing. This is way before computer-generated fireballs. The ones on film are the real thing, including the huge explosions going off behind the Terminator and John Connor as they race away on their motorcycle that took hundreds of gallons of gasoline to produce. One of the more memorable scenes to me that I had always thought was a computer effect was when the T-1000 gets shot point-blank in the face and his head splits in two. Well, it turns out about 90% of that was practical effects later enhanced by some computer elements. There was a upper torso, shoulders, and head model made of Robert Patrick's likeness with the motorcycle helmet on that splits in two and expands into that silvery mess. The actual explosion of it is what's enhanced by computer effects. There's even a soft mask version of that that slips over the entire stuntman's head as he's rolling away from the motorcycle in the movie. So, two practical elements made to pull off this effect. And the last thing I want to make sure that gets the credit it deserves is the chrome endoskeleton Terminator featured in this movie. I think this suffers from a been there, done that type of feeling. It's been in both films prior to this, so seeing it is cool, but it's not really new. But still, getting this thing on screen and to interact with the characters was another thing all in of itself. It took 3 models altogether. One full-size model to walk into the scene and center its sights on John Connor. This full-scale model took 6 puppeteers to operate. One cable to control the head and the neck, one person on the body movements, 2 people working the arms, one on each, one radio control operator for the eyes, and then finally one boom operator lifting the entire model up and down as it moved forward. The second model was a torso-to-head model that was built sitting on top of the puppeteer's shoulders and was used for the rapid turning shots. And finally, the third, not so well-constructed model was built specifically to be blown up, thus ending the screen time appearance for the endoskeleton Terminator in this film. So that takes care of about 75% of the 3D film, but there's still that last 25%, that last 3 minutes that needed to be done, as well as some crucial elements to be included before the film even really starts. And while James Cameron, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and all the actors were breaking new ground in the desert, another type of filmmaking pioneers were hard at work creating innovations of their own at that very same time. The production company Digital Domain was hired in creating the all-important nonstop action computer-generated finale and bringing a new Terminator model to life, the T-1000. The entire finale of this movie is computer-generated, and it uses all 3 screens of the theater. To cover 3,500 square feet with computer animation, Digital Domain put together a team of 47 computer graphic artists and 8 compositors to build the environment and create the T-1000. Now, originally, Digital Domain had plans to use a variety of commercial software and use each of the best features of each title to do what it does best. They started with an off-the-shelf software called Soft Image, and Soft Image was their application of choice for modeling, and that's what they started to use to model the T-1000. Now, during this modeling process and during some of the test rendering, they quickly learned that the all-reflecting surface of the chrome T-1000, some of the things that Soft Image was doing for them in this test might actually work out better for them. The ray tracing feature of Mental Ray in Soft Image created some fantastic self-reflections of the T-1000 model. This is a thing you may not notice if you don't look for it, but with all of its legs and its swinging arms, it does reflect a lot off of its own surface, and it's probably one of those things that if it's done badly, you'd notice that well before you notice when it's done well. The what I think is pronounced cinematics, if it's not cinematics, it's kinematics, it's cinematics with a K. The cinematics in Soft Image gave a much better animation result than expected in terms of the flowing smooth movement needed for a liquid metal monster. Using this one software package saved an immeasurable amount of time as opposed to their original plan of exporting between software titles. This afforded them the time to create some custom software needed for some of the elements they hadn't a prepackaged solution for. The Prism modules in Softimage allowed the T1 million to explode into millions of pieces, but it didn't give that exact look and texture that the pieces needed to sell that it was frozen solid, and it certainly didn't allow for those pieces to smoothly melt back into liquid metal. To fix this, Digital Domain created their own software that bridged those gaps called Shatter SOP, which stands for Shatter Surface Operation. There was also the environment for the T1 million to reside in, and that was all done in a beta version of the software called Alias 7.0. All these elements were rendered through a program called RenderMan, which you may have heard of before. It was developed by Pixar for their intensive CGI film work. Ironically, even with all these advancements in 3D filmmaking, computer-generated imagery, and custom software, the technology that would make this ultimately work was first invented in the 1950s and hadn't changed. The polarized lens 3D glasses visitors would wear in this attraction were the same that were invented almost 50 years ago at the time. Now, the very last element missing from the show, and probably the most unique, is the live actor element. The live actor portion of the show was under the direction of Landmark Entertainment, and they worked very closely with Digital Domain. The film Digital Domain would be producing is what the actors would be mostly interacting with. A replica stage was built not far from Digital Domain in LA. Actors would rehearse the timing, the lip-syncing of the film actor's dialogue, and everyone would work out the position on stage in relation to the action on the screen. This proved to be the most challenging, at least for Digital Domain. The slightest change in an actor's position on stage that took seconds for the live performance team to establish could mean days of work for the computer animators to match. But this was work that had to be done to pull the show off, and for the most part, it seems that all involved were happy to do it because at this point, everyone started to see exactly what the end product was going to turn out to be, and it was pretty amazing. So with the film in post-production and the live performers and computer artists finalizing their parts, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, and Edward Furlong would make one more appearance in front of the cameras, this time in a green screen studio where some of the final special effects and show elements were filmed for the final cut. And once that final version of this one-of-a-kind film was fully edited together, it was going to need a one-of-a-kind venue to experience. Well, technically three-of-a-kind, but there was this one first. The show would start with only the center screen, but it wasn't going to be an ordinary screen. This specifically designed screen would raise and lower, revealing the entrance door for the Terminator, as well as an exit back into the screen at the start of the movie. This screen weighs 2,500 pounds and moves real quick, and when the movie's not playing, it's incredibly loud. I have a recording of the screen raising, and I'll play it now. When the screen is initially raised, the entrance door is still covered until the last possible moment to keep the entire projection surface uninterrupted. Add in a little bit of fake smoke pumped up from the stage floor and the door opens, which is also ridiculously loud. I have that here. When the door does open, the Terminator comes out on a custom Harley Davidson Fatboy that is rear mounted onto a tracking system that actually guides the cycle along. The actor playing the Terminator has no control over the motorcycle itself. After John Connor climbs onto the back of the motorcycle, another jet of smoke comes out to cover the door, which opens, and the two ride off into the screen and effectively into the movie. Now, the Terminator is not the only performer to get a grand entrance. The actors playing the live versions of John and Sarah Connor that start the show are waiting up in the catwalks overhead. Then they rappel down to start the main action of this attraction. The T-1000 also has a specialized entrance mechanism. There's a small platform below the stage that quickly raises the actor as he simultaneously performs a standing motion to give that illusion of the silver mass forming into the body of the T-1000. Lastly, there is one more hidden door in the stage. This one is a little less dramatic. When the Terminator and John Connor enter Skynet on the screen and the lights go out, the live actors are raised on a platform to center stage. And this lift is used one more time at the very end to deliver Sarah and John Connor for their final appearance and effectively the epilogue of the attraction. Now, you heard me say, and you probably heard for yourself, that the sounds of the screen and the doors raising and opening are pretty damn loud. But chances are you didn't actually hear that in the show itself. In fact, I've sat in the front row of the show since learning and hearing that recording, and I can't hear it, even actively looking for it, knowing exactly when it's going to happen. And that is due to the theater featuring a customized sound system designed specifically for this attraction. The soundtrack is comprised of 24 tracks of digital playback, and it's played over 66 separate speakers throughout the theater. Now, the speakers are specifically and strategically placed so that the sound plays to match the 3D elements coming out of the screen and give a more immersive experience. Immersive experience. Now, moving a bit away from the stage, the T-70s featured in the opening sequence are their own little piece of cool as well. They are built from a carbon steel substructure and covered by a fireproof fiberglass polyresin. Each is controlled by a 25-horsepower hydraulic system pushing 300 psi of fluid pressure through each robot. At the very back of the theater, all this is monitored and controlled from the control room, which monitors the sound, the projection, and all the stage elements, and probably most importantly, the safety measures for the actors themselves. Each element involving an actor performing a stunt has a specific trigger point for the actor to verify that he's in place. The control room will acknowledge that verification before the stunt is released into the show, in a sense, keeping the actors safe. Now, going upstairs from there is the projection booth, which is arguably the heart of the attraction and certainly the heart of the name 3D and the name Terminator 2 3D. Each of the three screens requires two projectors to achieve this 3D effect, making a total of six projectors being used simultaneously during that grand finale. There's over 1 mile of film played from beginning to end of the show, and with the fast turnaround time needed for a theme park, all the film is run through film cabinets, creating a continuous loop for each projector, eliminating any of the time needed to reset and rethread the projectors between shows. With this nearly never-ending playing of each loop of the film every day, a specially formulated film was created for Terminator 2 3D to prevent it from breaking. This super secret formula gives the film a 3,300-pound tensile strength, meaning you could take a piece of this film and tow your car home with it. Now, going back to the front of the theater, to the screens themselves, the three screens are mounted on an almost 180-degree angle, effectively wrapping themselves around the audience. When the two side screens are revealed, there is a large gap between them, but rather than letting this blank space sit there, the ride designers incorporated these gaps into set pieces. Each gap is covered with an alcove, I guess you could call it, for Skynet, one of which the Terminator and John Connor do climb up into, and the actors transfer from their live performances back into the film actors for the final sequence. So not only a good use to cover the spot, but a good use to make that transition pretty seamless. And speaking of the live actors and film actors being completely different people, the lighting for this theater has been painstakingly designed to illuminate the actors just enough so that they can easily be seen, but not so much that you can see it's obviously not Linda Hamilton, Edward Furlong, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, or Robert Patrick in the early appearance of the T-1000. All of these elements, custom designs, and technologies brought to this venue brought the venue budget to a mere $36 million. And adding that with the film budget brings the overall price tag for this attraction to $60 million. So the next time you visit Terminator 2 3D, remember that every minute of your experience costs Universal Studios about $5 million to produce. When the venue did open on April 27th in 1996, it did so to rave reviews, much like its inspiration, Terminator 2 Judgment Day. When at full capacity, the venue can accommodate 2,500 visitors an hour, and it did so for the first few years. I know that's about how many people it felt like were in front of me when I first went to see it back in 1997. So here's a few more behind-the-scenes things that aren't readily seen and maybe not thought of in the usual viewing of this attraction. The wheels on the Terminator's Harley don't actually move, and if you sit close enough and take a good look, you'll notice that they're both actually a few inches off the stage. That's because it's being supported in the air, as I said, by a rear-mounted system, and the bike itself doesn't actually do anything. Although, it is a real motorcycle and could function, but in this case, it's all being done by a secondary system. The guns used in the Florida and Hollywood shows are real, but they have been modified to only fire blanks. The guns in Japan are props, and the gunfire is part of the soundtrack. If you watch a recording of the Japan show online or somewhere else, it is very strange to hear the gun and not see a muzzle flash after having seen it so many times at the other venues. I'm sure it's just as strange in person. I have not seen it, but maybe one day. But just seeing it online, it does stand out as being kind of odd. Much like any other movie, there's a couple of deleted scenes that didn't make it into the final version of the attraction. The most notable scene omitted from the work print is after the T-1000 is shot point blank in the face and falls over rolling on the ground. There's an additional scene where he stands up, head still split in two, and his arms are just kind of waving back and forth. It actually looks pretty freaking goofy, so it's a good cut. The live actors for Kimberly Duncan and the T-1000 both meet their demise at the same spot. For Kimberly, it's when she's strangled. For the T-1000, it's when he's shot one more time before he goes pursuing after John and the Terminator into the future. The actress that plays Kimberly lands on a crash mat to the left of the podium after she's strangled, and then the actress patiently waits there for quite a few minutes until the T-1000 is shot with the second shotgun blast, and he falls on the same crash pad next to her. That entire section of the stage, the crash pad, the podium, and the covering in front of the crash pad that you don't see, is then lowered out of the view as the movie plays, and once the lowering is complete, the actors are then able to leave the crash pad and go prepare for the next show. As stated in the beginning of the episode, the Hollywood venue did close in 2012, but the Japan venue is still running, and if you visit it, you'll undoubtedly notice that the show is entirely in Japanese. The Kimberly character, whose name is not Kimberly, I actually didn't write it down on my notes, unfortunately, does the pre-show entirely in Japanese, and the film is also in Japanese. It's the same film, but it's dubbed into Japanese. Here's a little bit of it as a sample. When the Hollywood venue opened, they improved the sound system. They added a stunning 100 additional speakers. This system was also duplicated in the Japan venue. And you can probably guess where you exit, in the gift shop, at least in the Orlando one, you sure do. And there's actually not as many T2 3D items these days. I had just gone there recently, and the things that stood out to me were t-shirts, a couple of action figures. They still have the official T2 leather jacket, which I guess must sell, but it is just, the price of it is frankly outrageous. Toy guns, and I did notice a mug that was covered with a bunch of T-800 endoskeleton skulls. There are some cool display items in the Orlando gift shop, though. There is a full-scale endoskeleton replica. There is a showcase of the costumes worn by Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, and Edward Furlong for the filming of the attraction. And something I hadn't noticed for quite a while walking through there is that up above your head is a model of a hunter-killer ship, which is kind of cool. If you get a nice close-up of it, you can't really... The detail on it is pretty darn good. You get a nice close-up shot of it, and it probably looks bigger than it actually is on a picture. The first time I visited this attraction was in early 1997. This was the second week I lived in Orlando. The first week I had moved into my apartment. If I had already moved into my apartment during the weekdays of that first week, I would have gone to Universal Studios, but I hadn't yet, so had to wait till the second weekend I lived in Orlando to go to Universal Studios. Terminator 2 was not my first ride. That was reserved for Back to the Future. I went there and wanted to see that above everything else. I wasn't really looking for the Terminator ride specifically when I was visiting Universal Studios. I'm sure I must have known about it, but when I came across the sign, I definitely had to go in. I didn't care how long the line was. I was a pretty decent Terminator fan, certainly a film action film fan, and 3D is at the time was something not that common, so I was going to make sure. I didn't care how long the line was. I knew I was going to be at Universal Studios many times after this, so I was going to get the ride in Terminator done that day. I really had no idea what the ride was other than the 3D movie, but I remember being pretty surprised when I saw Linda Hamilton and Edward Furlong themselves in their pre-show. After sitting down in the theater and once things got started, I remember that this kept getting better and better. The robot shooting over our heads, the Connors rappelling down from the stage, a Terminator on a motorcycle coming out of the screen, then the three screens and the actors on stage. I was completely blown away. I loved it. It still remains one of my favorite rides, not so much because it's much better than so many other rides at the park necessarily. It's mainly from that memory and the fact that it still remains quite unique. Still, to this day, to my knowledge, and certainly in my experience, this is still a one-of-a-kind attraction. Now, the last time I visited this attraction was 3 hours ago, and having all this research in the back of my head, watching it this time put an interesting perspective on everything. Now, having seen it recently, I can't sit here and say, oh, it holds up 100% in every way across the board. It does have some problems, and it is 18 years old. Most of my main issues are with the pre-show. That really dates this ride. Specifically the bit where the Cyberdyne television chooses a show for the grandmotherly type figure to watch.
Where a grandmother can choose from 5,000 television channels. And if she can't make up her mind, her television chooses for her.
It chooses Murder, She Wrote, and that dates this in so many ways. First, Universal used to have a Murder, She Wrote show that closed the year Terminator opened, and I have no idea if Murder, She Wrote is still on syndication anywhere. I'd imagine if I really looked, I could find it, but it's not popping up on any of the channels I watch. Another scene shows Shaquille O'Neal as a current pro basketball player. Now, most people probably recognize Shaquille O'Neal, know who he is, but they also know he is not currently playing professional basketball. So there's another element that works against the evergreen content of this ride, in a sense. For me, the biggest thing that stands out are the computers. They are the big, beige, clunky machines with the giant CRT square monitors, and it uses the old black and white Macintosh operating system way well before OS X. It's not even OS X or for a Mac in general. It is for Macintosh specifically. That operating system just makes me go ugh, each time I see it. But all that aside, the main show itself is still really good. Although I cringe every time the Terminator says, let's bust a move.
Let's bust a move.
Now, in fairness, that was just as cringeworthy and as lame in 1996 as it is now. Some of the CGI isn't completely up to par with today's standards, but the live performance in the 3D film hybrid is still unique and still well worth seeing. And now, having gone through all this research and really thinking about it, I'm somewhat afraid to say that this might be in its twilight years. The new film attractions are instituting 4K projections, and some of the existing attractions have been upgraded to 4K. Terminator has been largely untouched. It's been kept up, but it has not been improved. So I'm going to say enjoy this while you can. I have absolutely no information, haven't even read a rumor about its closing. I'm just putting my own facts together and thinking that I don't think it's going to go away real soon, but I don't think it's going to be around all that much longer either. So like I said, enjoy it while you can. If you haven't been on a while, I think you'll probably be pleasantly surprised how much the main show still holds up, especially entertainment-wise and definitely in uniqueness. I have learned a couple of things about where to sit when enjoying the show over the years. First, if you're jammed into an end seat, in this case, that's not bad. In most 3D shows, that really sucks and you don't get a good view of the screen and all that. But for this show, with the two additional screens, it's not bad. In fact, you get a better look at the action on the side screens when you're in one of these seats than you would in the middle of the theater. I'm not sure what to call the best place to sit, but I do know the worst is the front row. That row sucks. The opening 3D sequence is obscured by the podium. The speakers start right at the front row, so it's the weakest sound. I like to sit no less than the sixth row and anywhere back. The most unique experience is in the row that the attendants will point out as you enter the theater as the stationary rows, meaning they don't actually drop during the finale of the show. This is cool because the actors playing the Terminator and John Connor run down the row in front of that, and that's the closest you get to any of the live performers in this show. So if you're able to experience it twice, I'd say take the second trip and take the stationary row just to experience something that you're not going to get in any of the other rows in the theater. I think there might be an Easter egg of sorts in this movie, but I haven't been able to verify it. But I think I sort of kind of see it. I really, really want it to be there. In the original pitch of the ride, the finale was supposed to take place in the T-800 assembly area, and hordes of endoskeletons were going to attack the heroes. That was replaced, ultimately, of course, by the T-1 million. During the elevator scene, as the elevator lowers into Skynet, it passes several floors. And I swear one of those floors is a room full of T-800 skeletons, but it goes by so fast and they're at such a distance. I'm not quite sure it's what it is. I'm not 100% sure. I really, really want it to be, but again, I haven't been able to verify that. If you think you've seen that, please, please send me an email or post it on Facebook just to know I'm not alone. Again, no verification, but I really, really want that to be true. So, that is it for Terminator 2 3D Battle Across Time. At least that's all I'm going to do. Believe it or not, I could keep going, but I think we've taken in enough for this first episode. If you have anything to share about this attraction, any memories, more information, stories, anything about visiting it, share it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/neozazzpodcast, or please send me an email at attractionobsession@neozazz.com. That will wrap it up for this inaugural episode of Attraction Obsession. Join me next time when we'll take a closer look at Walt Disney World Animal Kingdom's Expedition Everest Legend of Forbidden Mountain, with possibly the biggest oops of all the attractions in Central Florida. To find out what I mean by that, make sure you subscribe to the show on iTunes and download the next episode of Attraction Obsession. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Attraction Obsession. Attraction Obsession is a NeoZazz.com production and part of the NeoZazz.com podcast network. For more great podcasts and original entertainment, please visit NeoZazz.com. For all the latest news and information for Attraction Obsession and NeoZazz.com, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/NeoZazzPodcasts.
In just a few moments, the doors to our main auditorium are going to be opening in toward you. Unless you rush them, and then they simply will be opening into you. And that's not super.
No.
Let's bust a move.